If you prefer manual, time-consuming processes, then this message isn't for you. But if you want to slash per loan cost and boost productivity, then exploring Indicom's Genius Suite is your next step. Integrate Genius into your operations or pair Genius with Indicom's expert mortgage services for proven ROI. Learn how to get Genius at work by visiting Indicom.com.
Hi, Housing News listeners. This is Alcina Lloyd, and I'm the producer of this weekly podcast, which is a proud member of the Industry Syndicate. Today, you'll be listening to episode 6 of season 4 of the Housing News podcast. In today's episode, Cindy Waldron, the Vice President of Research and Analytics at Freddie Mac, joins the Housing News podcast to discuss affordability and the trends Freddie Mac sees in different areas of the country. During the interview, Waldron explains how the nation's lack of housing inventory is affecting low to moderate income borrowers, as well as how COVID-19 will impact home ownership dreams of Americans who are currently struggling financially due to the pandemic. But before we listen, here's a brief word from our sponsor.
Now more than ever, homeowners and borrowers of the future need to understand impacts and options during times of financial hardship. Freddie Mac has made home possible for 50 years and is committed to providing assistance and clarity to the housing market. Through All for Home SM efforts, Freddie Mac Single Family is leading the future of housing through insights, education, mortgage, and business solutions. Learn more about resources to help you and the clients you serve at sf.freddiemac.com/affordable lending.
Thank you for listening, and here's the 6th episode of season 4 of the Housing News Podcast.
Welcome, everyone. I'm excited to jump into today's episode of the Housing News Podcast. I'm Sarah Wheeler, Editor-in-Chief at HousingWire, and today we are talking with Cindy Waldron, the Vice President of Research and Analytics in the Single Family Client and Community Engagement Division at Freddie Mac. Her responsibilities include driving business solutions for the single family business and its clients by leveraging research, data, and analytics to target and overcome barriers to homeownership. Through partnerships with lenders, nonprofit organizations, national intermediaries, and industry networks, she addresses the issues of homeownership preservation, affordability of housing, housing supply, and access to credit. A veteran of over 20 years in the mortgage industry, Cindy joined Freddie Mac in 1999 and has held leadership roles within the single family model and analytics and affordable lending and access to credit divisions. She holds an MBA in finance and entrepreneurship from the George Washington University and a bachelor's degree in math and business economics from Augsburg University. As you can see, Cindy is the perfect person to speak on our topic today, which is affordability. So welcome to Housing News, Cindy.
Thanks, Sarah, for having me. Really appreciate it.
We always like to find out a little bit about our industry leaders that we're interviewing. So how did you get into the mortgage industry?
Well, you know, I think as most people don't say, I want to be in housing when they're, you know, first get out of college. And so it's something that I think many of us kind of stumble upon. And so my story is no different in the stumbling. So I was working for a financial services company in Minneapolis and got engaged. My husband was here in the DC area where Freddie Mac is located. And we were getting married and I needed a job. And so he took my resume and went to the Freddie Mac job fair and shopped it around. And so, you know, I had a few interviews once and flew in and the rest is kind of history. I started out doing, you know, in the financial group and went into financial research component. And I thought I'd be there for three to four years. And I got hooked and I've been, like you said, over 21 years.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, you know, your husband did us a solid. So, you know, thank you to him for that's awesome. I love it. Well, let's talk about affordability. First off, you know, how does Freddie Mac track affordability, especially for first-time homebuyers? And what was the impetus for really measuring that?
Yeah, so this has been a process for us for a few years. In fact, Jaya Day on my team, her and I've kind of thought about this for, you know, probably 5-6 years and keep building on it, sort of like, how do we think about affordability and the borrower of the future and keep pulling the onion for that? So affordability, we had an affordability index, as a lot of people do, and we kept thinking about you know, how do we think about the borrower of the future and renters in particular? And not all renters are necessarily ready to, you know, go into single family, into the affordability, into the homeowner space, right? And so we really wanted to also think about the different areas that people lived and the different segments that they are. And so really, you know, everybody looks at affordability as this, you know, kind of macro look, but we really wanted to go deep dive into local markets. And really think about the first time home buyer, think about, you know, where, how the local markets, the housing stock of it is, right? And so you may be credit ready, but there may not be enough housing for you in these different areas. And what is the economic situation? So we're really trying to look at it as in the whole ecosystem of it. So we developed, it's kind of just coming out where we've, we're calling it the First Time Home Buyer Affordability Index. And it's unlike a lot of other affordable indexes, we actually are measuring the credit worthy renters. We're using a credit information, we're using closing data, we're using different data sources so that we can better understand is a credit worthy renter if they have income greater than or equal to the income earned by first-time homebuyers who recently purchased a home using a mortgage, then that renter can afford a house in the area. So our index is based on the area median income of the given locality, which allows us to specifically investigate local affordability of the low to moderate income creditworthy borrower, but not just the low income, but we can look at affordability in general. We can also look at affordability by, for equality reasons, like if we wanted to look into sort of African American or Hispanic, so what is the population there? What is their income and how are they comparing to their cohort, right? So this, we're really excited about this to be able to help drive and help source and think about affordability for the first-time home buyer and how it looks in geographically and into different certain target markets.
I think that's more relevant now than ever when you think about that millennial wave of people coming up. You know, they're just hitting their stride as far as their age for typical home buying, right? That stage in their life. So really interesting to look at creditworthy renters and see what that looks like. I'll be especially interested to see that as we work through COVID, because we do see, at least from the reporting we're doing, that definitely It is impacting renters much more than homeowners, right? I mean, we don't have this huge amount of people in forbearance, but you do have a ton of people who are having trouble making their rent. And so you wonder what that effect will be on homeownership.
Yes, we are seeing it hitting a lot of the renters, but we are also seeing that it's actually stimulating some of these millennials. So that, you know, we had like the first time home buyers, a lot of them were staying in place to their house, right? Because they, the interest rates were low and they didn't want to move to kind of the move up house, right? But during COVID-19, we're actually seeing some of those move to the next house because they want, they want additional space. They're having to work on online with their children. So, and, you know, millennials are getting to be 40, right? And so a lot of them are having children. I think a lot of us, you know, I'm 50, so I, others don't seem to age as much and they always seem, you know, like 20s, but, you know, they are getting to the point where their kids are at a certain age. And so they are looking to move up and some of the renters to get a house because they're wanting more space.
Really interesting. Yeah. You know, one of the keys to affordability is housing inventory, right? I mean, that when you have low inventory, you tend to drive up prices. So we know that housing inventory has been in short supply for the last several years. So how is it particularly scarce for low to moderate income borrowers?
That's a great question. And let me kind of chunk it up a little bit for first thinking about the new housing supply, and then thinking about our current housing supply. So our new housing supply, I have, if you look at sort of a timeline from like, you know, 1968 to even 2019. We've seen from 2018 to current, we're actually seeing really low levels of new housing starts. And a lot of the housing starts have been at the higher level because it's more, it's harder for builders to make money on the lower, the LMI housing, right? And so that's been more of a challenge to get new housing into that space. So we're only actually seeing, 2 years, 1982 and 1991, that had the same like lower levels as we have from 2008 to 2019. So we're having a huge issue with the new housing starting. And, we've already seen in 2019 where the inventory over household ratio has been at an all-time low. So that's how we've kind of gone into before COVID-19. And then I'll kind of talk about what COVID-19 did, but let me go now to say, well, what was our housing stock look like, our aging housing stock? So our team took First American tax record data from 2018. It was 72 million single family residents. And we looked to see what was the share of aging housing stock. And more than half of them were constructed prior to 1979. That was shocking. And then we plotted it in the United States. And so where we're seeing a lot of the aging housing stock is when you think about the Northeast, but kind of on the Canadian side, right? So you have like Indiana, Ohio, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, New York, all the way up through Maine. And then another bigger area that we see, all those states have predominantly like 60 to 80% of the aging housing stock before 1979. And then Ohio is another state that has very older as Nebraska, right? And then kind of interesting, the north part of like Montana and some areas in California. So we do see more in the south that we're not seeing as much of the aging housing stock. But again, in out east, we do see a lot of aging. So now, do we not only have kind of a shortage of the new supply, we're actually seeing a lot of aging housing shortage or a lot of aging housing. So then that's kind of setting the stage as what we came into, into 2020. And like I said, a lot of the housing was, not as much for LMI. And as I just mentioned before, given low rates, many people were staying in their starter homes and not upgrading. And others, we saw a big trend in people wanting to age in their house, right? And so that wasn't freeing up housing supply too. So all of this was really adding to one of the major issues for affordability is the supply of housing. Then came COVID. And so it was another kind of hit towards the supply of housing. We did see the spring housing sales delay into summer and fall. So we did see a lot of the spring sales shift. So that was kind of good. We also had, we also saw that the housing supply, so there's continuing a shortage. And the builders can't build fast enough. There's a lot of, even with people who are wanting to do remodeling, right? And so you see a lot of people with builders that they couldn't get builders to come or people to help remodel for months. There's a huge backlog of that. So based on this, even before we started to see COVID-19 hit, my team realized that one of the major barriers was this housing supply. And so we have a team on mine called Innovation in Housing. And one of the things that we focus on is housing supply and how do we, while we're not builders, what are some of the things that we can do to help? And so we launched really, as I said, I'm really big into like each community is different and you have to help each of them in different ways. So we launched like a 5 community-based initiative to really kind of understand some of the issues within those communities, and then test some things to help housing supply using our research and insights from my team. And then really what Freddie does well is we standardize and we scale. And so that's what kind of our next step is really, you know, let's work out the kinks, let's standardize and start scaling some of those. So we've really promoted a lot of renovation products. As I mentioned to you before, there is a lot of aging housing stock and we can help with that. We have a renovation product. We are working with that to say, you know, not everybody is a general contractor. Can we bring in nonprofits to help with that process, right? We found out in like Omaha is one of our areas and they didn't have a lot of developers for low to moderate income. And so we actually have put together this developer program. And so we're working with that. We put scholarships in place for, you know, minority. And in this case, we had four for minority women, right? And so we're working on how are things that we can do. We also are working on some shared equity programs to help revitalize different neighborhoods to make them more affordable for the LMI community. So all of this is, I know it's a long response, but we're using our research and insights to really try to impact communities and make data-driven decisions to help the underserved and to, as I mentioned, the housing supply is one of the a critical issue.
I appreciate that deep dive because these are difficult issues. So I think, you know, the talking about aging housing stock, I think is so important. You know, so I live in Texas and basically, you know, there's not a lot of aging stock. I mean, there's some, but we just keep spreading out. It's like, oh, we need some more housing. Great. We've got all this cheap land or, you know, depending on where it is, but you know, we just keep spreading. But you know, obviously lots of places don't have that same dynamic and also just, you know, the people who are stuck in the middle, not spreading out are the ones who have that aging stock. And how are they supposed to, if they're already having affordability issues, how are they supposed to not only buy that, but then be able to renovate? So interesting about your renovation product. Or products. That's awesome. What are some of the areas that are most affordable right now? Like, you know, and do those areas have things that attract home buyers, like jobs and schools? I mean, traditionally you think, here's a really, you know, cheap place to live. I could really afford a great house. Where am I going to work? How, you know, what does it look like to live in this, you know, inexpensive area? So what are some of those areas right now that are most affordable?
Sarah, that's a great question because as you mentioned, where you live really determines like where your kids go to school, you know, the different networks that you have, you know, the taxes that you pay, infrastructure, sort of the stability of your family. So people are looking at those when they move and where they have affordability. And even pre-COVID, we saw a shift from some of these high cost areas to areas that are affordable, but have all these different components, right? And even in COVID-19, we see a lot of that's actually even, we see a larger shift of that, right? So we see in the news where a lot of people from New York City are moving to different areas. Sometimes it's as close as even like Pennsylvania, where we see pockets of affordability, right? And so we have affordability there. Where we see in our affordability index, where a lot of it is, not too surprisingly, in the Midwest and in the South for affordability for all. So the Northeast is not as affordable. And then like the West Coast, and that's not too surprising. Those are where the high cost areas are. But what was really interesting is when we did this affordability index, which is why I was so passionate about having it based on like LMI, you see that it actually shrinks affordability. And in particular in the South. And so you'll see where when you look at affordability for all, the South actually seems very affordable. But when you actually consider sort of income and housing, you see that it's not as affordable in areas within the South.
That's so interesting to me. I wouldn't have known that. So that's interesting. You know, let's talk about some of the characteristics of a creditworthy renter, because that's one of the things that you guys measure to see, you know, what affordability looks like. So you know, what are some of those characteristics of that renter who's going to be able to buy a home in the short term? What do you see?
Yeah, so that's, I get a question about that a lot. And so I think it's more than just one component, but let's you know, everybody kind of knows about the FICO score and making sure that you have a strong FICO score. There's ability to pay current expenses. You know, there's reserves so that you have like a rainy day fund, right? A lot of, in particular, millennials and people who live in high cost areas don't have as much down payment. So there's, you know, but a lot of it is awareness too. So Freddie Mac has a lower down payment products. One is Home Possible, which is linked to income. So it would be 80% AMI or less for borrowers. But we saw the need in particular for high cost areas, where I mentioned in the East and West Coast in particular, where it's really expensive and having more than a 3% down payment is challenging. So we have a Home One, and that's not based on income. And so I think a lot of it's an awareness that there's these products out there. And then I just cannot stress enough financial education. This is one of the things that I think is the biggest characteristic that a new, you know, first-time home buyer, you know, which they should be focusing on. And we have, and it's free, Credit Smart, which is our credit, our financial criteria. We have, sorry, it's Home Buyer U, and we have a financial component to it. So this is free, and it, you know, we partner with a lot of our counseling agencies and realtors to promote Credit Smart. The curriculum is an interactive platform that offers videos, knowledge checks, and, you know, self-paced trackers for the users. We expand the focus of these key topics to prepare consumers for home buyer for the process, develop their lifelong money management skills. You know, we've even used some of this within like junior achievements, because we believe that it's not just about when you're wanting to have a home, but this Credit Smart curriculum is really, you know, we're going in an overhaul, and we really think it should be, we had it from 16 to 116. So we're targeting all different life times where you have, you know, maybe it's about making decisions about college. Maybe it's about when you get a first home or marriage or different things like that. So that, and even Credit Smart talks for renters, right? So a lot of renters don't realize you should have, you know, renter insurance, right? So it gives you kind of checklists on how to be better prepared for different financial times in your life. And so, again, I can't stress enough about, you know, if you have the discipline and keep understanding, you know, how is it to save so that when I, you know, it's not just about getting into the house, but it's having a sustainable homeowner throughout their life.
Super interesting point. You know, when we talk about creditworthy renters, as I said in the intro, you know, there's some different things going on this year. So what are some of the factors that might affect their ability to buy, you know, as they've been affected by COVID? What are you seeing there? What do you anticipate seeing?
Yeah, so first of all, thinking about the economics of how has COVID-19 affected us. So our chief economist at Freddie Mac has predicted about the 30-year fixed mortgage will be around 3% in 2021. So that's good news for affordability. So these low rates will keep monthly payments down. House price growth, which was around 5 to 6% here in 2020. So that has been more challenging because, and that's been spurred mainly because of the demand for housing. And so COVID-19 has added a lot of people wanting more space, wanting to go into the country. You know, we're all working at home, we're having the kids at home. So we're all wanting more space. That's adding a demand. So that's adding pressure towards affordability and even the housing stock, as we said. In 2021, we expect the rate for house price growth to be 2.6. So that will that should help a little bit, that it's not growing as fast as the 5 to 6%. That said, again, the housing shortage is still going to be very challenging. In COVID-19, building new housing is going to be hard. And then even though we're trying to do renovation to a lot of these housing, there's still, you know, we need more people to do the building, and we need these, you know, skilled workers. And we also know COVID-19 has especially hit communities of color. And I think that's important to put into the context as, you know, how that's impacting them. And so we're really focused on sustainable homeownership, as I keep telling you about that. And so what we have a Help Starts Here program, so that in particular for those who were hit by COVID-19, so they understand, you know, their options and forbearance. And, you know, we've done a lot of, my team in housing outreach, it's done a lot of seminars and really worked on where do we see, like, if there's delinquencies, do they know that they can go into forbearance and what are their options? And so that has been one of the biggest drivers that we've been able to focus on recently, is how do we get sustainable homeowners? Because it's really hard once they lose a house to get them back in. And so we focused mainly on that. But kind of surprisingly, and I think it's a lot of because people are at in their house a lot, that we are still seeing the demand for first-time homebuyers.
Yeah, so, you know, talking about sustainable homeownership, what are some of the most important factors in building in that resiliency in homeowners? Like you said, it's easier to keep them in their home than if they lose their home to get them back in. I mean, you know, the economic impacts on someone who loses their home to foreclosure, it could just be lifelong. So what are some of the factors in building resilient homeowners?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, we're doing the Help Starts Here program and having that campaign. A lot of the other things that we're doing, I'll say like in innovation in housing, we're having different alternatives for them. So part of it is having the knowledge that they can go into, some of these programs that we're putting together. Others are if they're having long-term issues, staying in their home, we're trying to think of ways through nonprofits and having community, like working on community land trusts, right? So that way that even if they, the nonprofit will purchase the home and then we'll sell it back to the borrower based on their income. And that way they can still have grow equity or grow, you know, wealth for the family. So we're kind of looking at a different and parallel, like, you know, is this really impacting and how can we work with nonprofits and work with our partners to better serve that community, all the way up to maybe they just need a short-term solution and working with like our servicing units and going out there and using our nonprofit arm and our network to get that out to the individuals.
What about, you know, we know that there's a large gap in Black homeownership. You know, you touched on this, that COVID has disproportionately affected some communities more than others. Even before COVID there, though, we saw that gap between Black and white homeownership. So what are some of the most impactful ways to increase Black homeownership?
I really think the industry needs to have more of a holistic approach on African-American homeownership. It's not a short-term solution. We need to really think kind of long-term and thinking about home in a sustainable way. So again, it's not just about getting people into the home. It's about the sustainability. And so one of the issues that we know is African Americans have 10 cents to the dollar in wealth, so they can't draw upon their family as often whites can, right? So there's multiple challenges with that. So one is they don't have rainy day funds, like oftentimes their counterparts in white. So there's challenges for that. So that's why it's really important for financial education, in particular in the African American community. There's also the down payment. If you only have 10 cents to the dollar, we've noticed that why a lot of whites can use, you know, parental money, or they can use money that they've had from another house. African Americans can't do that as much. And so that's also this awareness campaign that I said that there's, you only need to have 3% down. So it's having people understand that still today, a lot of people think they need 20% down instead of the 3%. So there's work on that. And then on the down payment, we're actually working on having a national down payment database that will be a single source for the entire industry. So what we do well is we'll have, you know, like kind of standardized. So guidelines will be maintained by the providers through a standard interface. users such as lenders, doc providers, loan origination systems will be available through APIs for integration and customer solutions. So this is going to be a multi-year effort with coordination with the MBA, FHFA, and other stakeholders. And so we're hoping to get sort of a minimum viable product out in 2021. And this really is going to be groundbreaking to think about how we can utilize these down payment products and to be able to help with, you know, getting African Americans into homes, because that's what that is a big barrier to, is the down payment. And again, utilizing low down payment products is huge. I think education, again, a lot of African Americans are first time generation homeowners. So they can't draw on their on their parents to say, well, what did you guys do? And how did you, you know, what happened here? And a lot of the African Americans through the Great Recession lost their house. And so it's also the stigma for African Americans that it's, that's kind of scary. Like, you know, my parents lost it. How do I make sure that that doesn't happen to me? So we're doing a lot of work through through education. We work with a lot of the historic Black colleges and universities to better educate them, to get them into different programs. So we work a lot with the youth to make sure that they're getting ready too. So you, I think you have to look at it again in a holistic manner, not just about, okay, who's ready right now, but work on the pipeline. Get them, you know, get them into homes and get them into sustainable homes. And so I think that if you think about it as a long-term game, that's how we're going to get to reduce the homeownership gap.
Yeah, I love that idea about the, you know, looking at this long-term and what we can do. You know, we're almost out of time here, but I did want to ask you one last question. You know, as you work on increasing affordability, what do you see in the current landscape that you're optimistic about?
I'm really optimistic about some of the movements that I've seen as far as, you know, the equality. I think people are really paying attention to, you know, the homeownership gaps. I'm really encouraged. I'm a quant in nature, and so I'm excited about the data that we didn't have even 10 years ago. And I think I'm a huge believer in data-driven decisions instead of just like the hearsay of it. So we know better, not just throwing out the net, but we know exactly where the fish are to get them, right? And so we know how to better source mortgage-ready individuals. We know where people who may not have as good of a credit score, how do we think about targeting them to build their credit score? Having programs to think about, you know, how do we build wealth and have them understand, here's the different ways that we can, so African Americans, we can close the wealth gap too. So I really think that it's about having better tools and really thinking holistically instead of just getting people into the home. We're really spreading out and saying, how do we think about somebody who's in grade school? Are we teaching them to have a bank account? Are we teaching them to be, you know, thoughtful about like what, you know, the college is, and, you know, how do we think about it as a life cycle versus just thinking about getting people into homes? So I'm very encouraged by some of the things. I think we better understand the challenges. And, you know, I feel like for ourselves, we keep thinking about where is, you know, it's not just about affordable housing. It's not just about some of the regulatory thing. It's really about what are the barriers to home ownership and solving for those.
Well, Cindy, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insight on these incredibly important topics. Really enjoyed the conversation and appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Housing News Podcast. Please don't forget to give us feedback and rate us on iTunes. Also, make sure to check out HousingWire's latest podcast, The Daily Download, which is a daily wrap of HousingWire's hottest stories, now available on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcast, and more. We'll see you next week.